For the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pins the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times Magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
Welcome back, everybody. Time for our Cannabis Q&A. We got Dr. Mitch on the line. How you doing, Doctor?
Having a pretty crazy day, but all in all, okay.
Well, we hope it gets better for you, and this will be painless. It'll go real quick.
Sure thing.
All right. So, of course, we have our phone lines open at 84-420 Radio if anyone has a call-in question. We've also got our chat line open at ustream.tv. And before we get too deep into this, let's remind everyone that if you can't get enough of Dr. Mitch, you can now get more Dr. Mitch. He's got a new podcast available on cannabisradio.com. How's that been going, Dr. Mitch?
It's, let's just say I bow to you, Russ. It's a lot more difficult than it looks.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the compliment. All right. So in the news today, there's all sorts of interesting things to get to, but I want to start with the main one that seems to be getting a lot of play. And Paul Armentano did a great job of pointing out the media schizophrenia on this, but the recent Journal of the American Medical Association meta-analysis of medical marijuana and saying most uses of medical marijuana wouldn't pass FDA review. What's the real detail on this people should take away from this this study?
Well, when they see the steam coming out of my ears, they know something must be awry. None of this is really about medical cannabis. They meta-analyzed all medical cannabinoids. So there's Marinol, there are these THC-mimicking drugs, there's cannabidiol, there's THCA. And they put all the apples and oranges together and said, none of the fruit's any good. And it's completely unfair to say that medical cannabis doesn't work simply because of these studies. The article itself in JAMA was relatively responsible about this, but the headlines have just been terrible. And even in the LA Times, they're saying, medical marijuana, blah, 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 blah. There are 28 studies, and I think only two or three of them actually look at medical cannabis. So the rest of them are these artificial mimicking things or just THC by itself, and it's unfair to generalize from these conclusions.
Yeah, it's a shame. And one thing that I caught in this review is the UK Daily Mail did a piece on this where they said cannabis, you know, medical cannabis doesn't work for this, that, the other thing, and pain, and then had to admit two lines later that, well, they did find out that there was some evidence for pain. In fact, don't we have more evidence for cannabis's efficacy regarding pain than anything else?
And what's crazy is they also did the nausea and vomiting stuff, and I mean, that's one pretty well established since about 2800 BC, and they said, no, that's no good either. Well, what a surprise. Yeah, Marinol doesn't work because you don't want to swallow it because you're vomiting. I mean, it was completely inane.
Yeah, ridiculous. They never seem to note those good things in those reports. All right, let's get to, there was a big hearing up on Capitol Hill, and we covered this on 420 Radio on CBD with Senators Gillibrand and Booker, and I think Feinstein and Grassley were the chairs of this committee. And of course, Kevin Sabet showed up there, and there was a big showdown where he was on a panel with another doctor who actually works with Schedule II drugs, and they were arguing back and forth about whether or not Schedule I versus Schedule II would make any difference in CBD research. Did you catch those, and what did you have to think about Sabet's performance?
So my jaw hit the ground about three times during all of these, and Sabet actually said nice things about cannabidiol. In truth, Schedule II is a giant pain in the ass for researchers anyway. It would be a step in the right direction. The fact that Kevin Sabet, of all people, is actually saying, hey, if we had, you know, access to cannabidiol alone, it would be better, wasn't something I expected. But Nora Volkow also said, hey, this Mississippi situation where you can only get cannabis from one place if you're doing research on it, it has to stop. And I was blown away by that, immediately emailed Rick Doblin. He was already on top of it. So, I mean, I feel like the fact that this conversation is happening is great. I'm just sad that it's taken us this long to make this kind of progress.
Yeah, and Dr. Volkow from National Institutes of Drug Abuse, actually, isn't there a quote where she says there is no scientific reason marijuana should be in Schedule I?
Oh, and she literally said she would prefer if Oxford didn't have to be the lone source of marijuana for research. And I, if somebody had, you know, bet me $1,000 a year ago that she'd say that, I would have lost a bet.
Yeah, it was amazing. She was on the panel with Throckmorton from the FDA and Raprazizi, I can't pronounce his name, from DEA, who all tried their best to try to say, well, you know, Schedule One, it's really no big deal for research. Aside from all these other things you have to do, it's really no big deal. And part of me kept thinking, and I think Senator Booker picked up on it, was, well, gosh, if it's no big deal, then why have it? What's the point in having that restriction?
And I want to emphasize, he can barely pronounce NIDA. I mean, it's not like he's some kind of drug expert. If it's self-evident to somebody who's really not into this, it ought to be self-evident to them.
Yeah. Now, speaking of marijuana research, the Obama administration did a great thing in removing a public health service review for marijuana studies. What was this, and how does it differ studying marijuana than any other Schedule I drug?
So it's interesting that the hoops for Schedule I drugs tend to be worse for marijuana than even the opiates. So you have to have this extra step where the Public Health Service has to go through it. And at least currently, you can only get marijuana from the one place, this University of Mississippi location that provides it. Well, obviously, you know, you can get opiates anywhere. It's just markedly easier to get a whole lot of other Schedule I drugs. So this is at least removing that one hurdle of this PHS review, which has been, you know, a time-consuming hassle and difficult, and they tend to just really drag their feet a lot. So I think it's going to make things go a little faster. I don't think it's necessarily the cure, and I'm certainly wishing that somebody had, you know, the sense to say at least Schedule III, but yeah. You know, one thing at a time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if synthetic THC is sitting there at Schedule III, it seems like the natural stuff should be there too, at least.
Oh, yeah, I mean, at absolute most. And I really, you know, envy all my pals in your neighborhood and in any of the states where medical and recreational markets are opening up. You know, I wish I were there gathering data right now.
I'll see if I can gather some data for you. Now, when it comes to those Schedule I drugs, you were saying that marijuana was the only one that had to go through this public health review. And is it not also true that marijuana is the only one for which there's a monopoly on the research supply?
Exactly. So, I mean, there are tons, at least four companies that produce, you know, the medical opiates that people do work on. Things like nitrous and, you know, I mean, these drugs that you never even think about, where there are these guys at the University of Chicago who have, you know, approval for them, and they can basically make people bid for, you know, the business. But if you want cannabis, there is one place and one place only. And it just seems ironic, given that that one place could be my backyard,
yeah.
But instead, legally, it can only be from Mississippi.
Yeah, and I've seen LV's and Irv's tins of Mississippi weed, and the patients deserve better weed for the studies as well. All right, let's get to, this was another groundbreaking, mind-blowing study. Booze's impact is greater than pots on driving. Who'd have thunk it, Dr. Mitch?
And what's so sad is we've had these data since the late 90s, of course, in Amsterdam, where they were gathering them. And what breaks my heart is that, you know, we're still pulling people over and measuring metabolites that have nothing to do with their current level of impairment, while, you know, meanwhile, people, you know, who've had a couple of drinks aren't under the same kind of scrutiny, and they're the ones who are much more likely to cause an accident, and particularly a lethal accident.
I think people are starting to get the hang of this. I mean, as I look through the comment section on some of these stone driving stories, almost everyone, you know, it never fails that there's someone bringing up the point that metabolites means it's been metabolized, as in past tense. You're not finding anything out other than someone's a pot smoker. We're starting legalization on July 1st, and our DUI laws aren't changing here in Oregon. And we've got some of the media down here saying, oh my God, there's going to be a rash of stoned driving. What can you tell us about the effect of the legalization in Colorado and Washington on their stone driving figures?
Well, what's funny is everybody thought, you know, the sky was going to fall, and it just has not been the case. I'm encouraging law enforcement everywhere to rely on roadside sobriety tests, the, you know, walk a straight line, ride your unicycle, those kinds of motor tests, rather than anything else. And, you know, I want to call out to all of us, hey, you know, driving high is not a great idea. But we're not seeing those outrageous sparks and, you know, people pulling over on the side of the road to eat a donut or anything like that. It's just not happening. And I think in part, driving is kind of a buzzkill.
Yeah, I always like to say it's not as if legalization invents cars and marijuana. We've been out here, folks, and there hasn't been blood on the freeways yet. We are speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. He is also the chair of the Normal Board of Directors. And if you'd like to get your question answered on the down low, maybe keep it private, not talk about it on the radio, you can always email at 420research@gmail.com. That's 420research@gmail.com. And when it comes to this marijuana and driving, of course, you should not drive impaired. And isn't there some evidence to show that marijuana consumers are more cognizant of their impairment and therefore better able to resist that situation?
At least in Roby's data, where they knew they were being watched, and so that's been the argument as well, they don't always know they're being watched. But we actually saw folks were less likely to try to pass other cars. They increased their stopping distance, so they see a stop sign, they start stopping much earlier. They're much more likely to leave plenty of space between their car and the car in front of them. So I say don't drive high, but drive as if you were.
There you go. Drive as if you were. And remember, folks, that in all states, it's illegal to drive under the influence of drugs. But in some states, it's more illegal. I've got a great map out there. And of course, normal.org has some resources to tell you where the per se DUID states are. There's some of these places where you get caught with any nanogram of metabolite in your system, and not only are you guilty of a DUI, you go to jail for 24 to 48 hours on the spot. So make sure to check that out at normal.org. It's about all the time I got here for Dr. Mitch. Anything else before you go? You know, it's my last like 36 hours as a criminal in this state.
All I want to say is I'm looking forward to celebrating your return to regular society.
Yay, I'm no longer an outlaw. Thanks, Dr. Mitch, and we'll talk to you next week from Legal Oregon.
Looking forward to it.
All right, folks, stay tuned. We're going to have time for a radical rant. Speaking of legal Oregon, what exactly is becoming legal? I mean, you know we get to possess an ounce, but do you know how much you have to possess before you get a felony? Can you grow your four plants if you live within 1,000 feet of a school? What's the tax rate going to be, and when are the pot shops going to open? We'll answer those questions and many more when we come back on the Russ Belville Show.
To the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
420 Radio, the activist radio station.